Lecture 9, Biblical Views of Nature and Law.
Another important channel of thought that has been extremely influential in the history of natural law thinking comes from the Jewish and Christian scriptures. Here we depart from the world of Rome and Greece and move to the Near East, to the realm of Palestine, and we consider in particular a religious tradition which is very strong on the notion of revelation, the revelation that was made by God to the Jewish people over centuries, and then the special revelation that comes with Christ. In both of these cases, Christian and Jewish scriptures, we will see themes that are of enormous importance for the doctrine itself of these religions, as well as for the history of natural law thinking. And it strikes me as having just the opposite direction to it that we saw in the Greek and Roman thinking that we have been examining, where for Greek and Roman thought, nature was a category first, and only slowly and gradually did we start thinking of morality in terms of law. In the biblical perspective, the trajectory is just the opposite, namely that law is a much more important category for much of the history of revelation, and that nature is not much of a category at all until nearly the end of that period of revelation. So we'll be going in just the opposite direction. What I'd like to do in this lecture is first to consider the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament, and especially to consider one aspect of them, namely the importance of law as a biblical category. And then after we finish there, I'd like to look at something from what is sometimes known as the intertestamental period, and particularly from the wisdom literature tradition, making a philosophical contribution to this. And then thirdly, we'd like to turn to New Testament, and again, impossible to do all of that in but one lecture, but to turn to the writing of St. Paul on the Romans as being a place where this natural law theme has special prominence. First, then, the notion of law as a biblical category. If one looks over the vast number of books that constitute the Jewish scriptures, one finds as a central idea the notion of law. It occurs in various forms. For instance, there's the notion of berit, or covenant. And I think in many ways this is the central concept of biblical revelation. The berit, or covenant, refers to an arrangement that is more solemn than any human contract. It is a very consecrated relation in which God's stands toward the chosen people, the people of Israel, by a covenant or very solemn form of agreement. The Bible records a series of these solemn covenants as taking place. One looks back at Genesis, for instance, and finds a very formal relation between God and Adam at the time of the creation of the world. And even after the removal of Adam and Eve from the garden, Adam is still the steward of all creation and is envisioned as commissioned by God with a kind of stewardship over all creation. We see a second form of this covenant at the time of Noah after the flood, that even though the entire world has been destroyed because of the vast amounts of evil, a new covenant is established with Noah. And in this new covenant, the just and the unjust will live together. As the scriptures say, God will reign upon the just and the unjust alike. And only later on will God sort out the problems of injustice and justice. But the covenant has been established, and Noah knows what he and his successors are supposed to do. Thirdly, there is a covenant that is mentioned with Abraham. If we try to date this historically, it seems to come from around 1850 BC, when God takes Abraham from the city of Ur in the Chaldees, the area of land that we nowadays associate with southern Iraq, and chooses Abraham to be the father of this people, to make his great trip up the rivers, across the Fertile Crescent, and then down into the Promised Land, the area that is nowadays called Palestine. And he does so under the aegis of a covenant which God has made with him. Fourthly, there is the covenant that is cut between God and Moses at the time of the exile in Egypt, that after they have been in Egypt for many generations, some 400 years, and God is now ready to free his people from that servitude, he leads them out into the desert, and at Mount Sinai, he establishes a sacred covenant with them. This is perhaps the best known of the covenants. It is the source of the Ten Commandments, the actual stipulations of the covenant that occur both in Exodus and Deuteronomy. Fifth, there is a covenant that is made with King David, in which we renew the promises that God had made and renew the stipulations of the commandments. But God makes a further promise. He makes the promise that there will always be a king from the house of David, and that he will specially rule Israel by virtue of this king. And then in the book of Jeremiah, there is the promise at Jeremiah 31:31, the promise of a new covenant, an everlasting covenant. Christians will later take this to be the covenant with Jesus. In the course of this review of biblical history, all I mean to suggest is that among the important items that could be enumerated from the biblical texts, this notion of covenant is a recurring notion that occurs in text after text and is regarded as the most sacred concept because it is the establishment of a relation between God and human beings. The most elaborate descriptions of the establishment of this covenant are found in the books of Exodus and Deuteronomy. And one of the interesting things that scholars have noticed about those texts in Exodus and Deuteronomy is how the actual establishment of the covenant follows the rubrics that are typical of suzerainty treaties in the ancient Near East, namely that these treaties always begin with a superior and his vassals, his inferiors, and they recall both the names of the parties and the history of their families, how they've been associated with one another. And then at a certain point, they stipulate what the covenant requires, in this particular case, that God is God and will be a God for this people. And the people are to obey various commandments, hence the importance in Exodus and in Deuteronomy of those Ten Commandments, which are the central portion of the covenant. And then finally, there is a set of blessings. Here's the blessings you will enjoy if you indeed honor this covenant. And a set of curses. Here's what's going to happen if you violate it. The only thing that's not present in these biblical texts that is present in the other texts of covenants in the ancient Near East is that there's in those other treaties, they always swear by the gods. But of course, this is a treaty between God and his people, and God can swear by no one other than himself. But in every other respect, the structure of the treaties recapitulates a political form that was known in the ancient Near East. This particular treaty between God and his people has as its center the Torah. Torah is a name which means the law, and it consists of the first five books of those Hebrew scriptures, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. But it can also refer not just to the collection of those five books, but it can refer to that portion of the covenant which is the law, namely the Ten Commandments. When taken, for instance, in the form of Exodus, we find it in chapter 20. Deuteronomy repeats this in chapter 5 and gives the set of 10 commandments. These are the 10 stipulations. It is the central concern about how people are to behave. It is not only something that God has chosen, but it is the great source of morality for the Jewish people. One also finds within Torah in the larger sense, namely in the sense of the five books of the Bible, one finds that book known as Leviticus. And Leviticus, which is a collection of laws and precepts, especially pertaining to worship and ritual and sacrifice. I'm especially fond of chapters 17 to 26 of Leviticus, which is the holiness code, what it is that you must do in order to be holy according to these covenants. Now, while much of the book of Leviticus is devoted to a record of priestly traditions, an analysis of purity rules and ritual forms, there's also, and this very important for our natural law considerations, there's also a very careful enumeration of the types of creatures that God has created. And the reason why I say this is important to natural law reasoning is that we have seen already in the first lectures in this series the importance of nature and natural kinds, namely in Greek philosophical analysis, by identifying the kind as distinguished from any other kind, one can start to see the teleological dimensions of this kind and how you devise an ethics based on the end that is already embedded in the nature of the being. Once you understand the kind and its natural end, you can see how to get from beginning to end and how to devise an appropriate morality for the human natural kind. Well, the Bible doesn't talk in terms of nature, natural kinds, or philosophical analysis. But you see in Leviticus some of this same kind of reasoning under another name, namely a set of distinctions among the various kinds of creatures and a sense of what's good for this creature and what's good for that creature. In a way, it's very close to some of what is natural law thinking. You also find in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy a set of all the many other statutes and precepts and laws that must be observed. There are more than 500 of them. And the way in which the Jewish people understood these additional laws and statutes was as a kind of fence around the Ten Commandments. The idea was these Ten Commandments are so sacred, and they so define how you ought to conduct your life. Law is the central moral category. But to avoid getting anywhere close to violating any of the Big Ten, there is this picket fence of 500 and 600 other little laws of ritual purity which you must observe. And if you are sufficiently attentive to never violating any of those small detail laws, then you'll never get close to violating what it is they guard, the Ten Commandments that are at the center and within the picket fence. To step back and reflect for a minute, what many a thinker in the natural law tradition has seen here in biblical tradition is a correlation between those divine commandments and natural law. Clearly, within the biblical texts, this law is the law because God said so. It is the law that is obligatory because the divine source has commanded it. And yet natural law theorists have regularly seen a correlation between what the divine commandments specify and what, by our reason, reflecting on our nature, we can come to understand as morally right. Let's just do a couple of examples, but we'll see more of this in the lectures to come. Those first three commandments that all pertain to the worship of God, namely that there is only one God and only He should be adored, that one should never take the name of God in vain or try to make an image of God because God is spiritual and can't be captured by a material image, or that one should honor God by observing the Sabbath, while they get to a level of particularity, for instance, the Sabbath, every seventh day we should honor God by truly worshiping and not by working on the day of the Sabbath, that's probably a greater degree of specificity than natural law could come to. I don't think that natural law by itself would ever get us to the conclusion we should worship God on every seventh day. But natural law itself can say, if there is a God, we should worship it. And these three commandments are telling us to worship that God and to honor it by a conduct that is appropriate to worship. Or, if we take the other commandments that the Ten Commandments exhibit, things, for instance, such as honoring parents, a positive commandment, or not committing murder, not committing adultery, not stealing, not bearing false witness, any of those positive or negative commandments that are explicitly stated as commandments in Exodus and Deuteronomy have been thought by natural law theorists to reflect on what conclusions we should come to when we look at our natures. Our natures invariably involve relations of dependence to our parents, and not just when we're small having to obey them in the way that a child needs to obey one's parents, but when our parents are aged and in need of care, we must continue to do what honoring those parents requires, and that there's a natural obligation to honor one's parents, which can be determined by reason reflecting on our nature, just as there's a commandment to that effect. Or the commandment against murderers, adultery, commandment against stealing. Those commandments are also reflected upon reason, reflecting on what the social obligations we have must be if we're to live peaceably, that there can be no private license to kill, even though there is a right to self-defense, that we cannot abandon our marital promises, that we cannot arbitrarily steal the property of one another. Exactly how we're going to organize property relations, or exactly how we're going to organize marriage ties, will have considerable cultural contribution. But the basic fundamental natural law obligation is the same in natural law reasoning as in these divine commandments. Hence a strong sense of the correlation here between the biblical category of law and what natural law theorists are inclined to recognize. Let me turn now to another part of biblical literature, the sapiential books or the wisdom books. This is arguably the most philosophical part of the Bible. These are the books that begin with Psalms and Proverbs, and then go on through Job, and then Koheleth, sometimes known as Ecclesiastes, Sirach, sometimes called Ecclesiasticus, the Song of Songs, the Book of Daniel, and ultimately the Book of the Wisdom of Solomon. Now, in this tradition of biblical literature, what one finds is something very philosophical. Consider, for example, the Book of Proverbs. It's one of my dad's favorite books of the Scriptures, and what Dad likes to do is the right way to read Proverbs. You can't be reading through Proverbs straight through very quickly. I think you'd just be overwhelmed by the vast number of Proverbs. But rather, what he loves to do is to take two or three of them and then just sort of chew on them all day. And I think that's how they're meant to be read. They're intended to teach a person, especially a young person, what the moral life and what the religious life should be by reflecting in these pithy sayings on what the wise in the community have discovered. But there's a certain philosophical problem that emerges, and it starts to emerge already in the book of Proverbs, and then we see it coming to full fruition in the book of Job. Namely, the book of Proverbs gives you the impression that if you are good and do what these proverbs suggest, you will be rewarded with much blessing. Whereas if you are in some way or other a transgressor of the law, you will suffer the consequences of your transgression. But we all know the problem that sometimes bad things happen to good people, and sometimes the wicked seem to prosper. What are you going to do with that? If you had only the book of Proverbs and its relative optimism that the good will be rewarded and that the evil will be punished, there seems to be something incompatible in daily life that goes against the grain of Proverbs. I take Proverbs to be a matter of moral exhortation, a matter of encouraging us to live well, and not necessarily a promise of exactly how it's going to work out in this life. The book of Job brings that out in tremendous complexity, namely a strong sense of an innocent person, a good man, who is afflicted by the loss of his children, the loss of his servants, the loss of his property, and yet who refuses to curse God. No matter what his wife urges him, curse God, won't you? Or what his erstwhile friends encourage him, namely, if you're suffering, you must have been guilty. Job insists that he has done nothing wrong, and that he himself will never curse God. Rather, he must have the attitude, I've received these things as blessings. If now they are taken away, they weren't mine. They weren't something that I was owed. In a way, Job has understood the change in the covenant that came with Noah. Because where the covenant with Adam had suggested, if you are good, you will stay in the garden, but if you misbehave, out you go, there was an immediate correlation between reward and punishment. Whereas with Noah, we find that the world has been destroyed and that God is establishing a new covenant. And the covenant as it was established with Noah was, God will reign upon the just and the unjust alike, but never again will there be a flood that will overwhelm even the evil in the world. And as a sign of that, there will be the great rainbow, a suggestion that God will honor this promise and will allow the just and the unjust to dwell together alike. It gives us no incentive to merely tie ourselves up within ourselves. There's rather still a strong suggestion that we must work for justice in this life, work for justice in our own personal lives, and work for justice in our communal lives, but we cannot expect that things will always work out and must still have faith. That's Job. Ecclesiastes, or sometimes called Koheleth, reinforces that position. Koheleth is the book that begins, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, and it gives a sense that we won't necessarily be able to figure it out. I rather like to think of that book of Koheleth as rather like existentialism in the Bible. Life may seem absurd, and yet we must still have faith. But the wisdom literature continues. The book of Sirach, sometimes called Ecclesiasticus, holds a position rather like the book of Proverbs. God will ensure that it will all work out, but he won't necessarily ensure that it will all work out in the short term. It will work out in the long term. And the book of Sirach adds a sophistication, it adds a tremendous profundity about this problem of evil, namely, that sometimes evil comes as something which will stretch us and force our characters to grow larger. Sometimes evil will be a test, is to see if we are going to be faithful. And sometimes evil will simply come because God is so intent upon preserving our freedom. And freedom means that actions will have their consequences, even if the consequences are sometimes the suffering of the innocent. God will make it up to the suffering of the innocent, but meanwhile will allow tragedies and crimes and other things to occur. This is what is required as the metaphysical framework for freedom to be possible. Sirach therefore gives a certain encouragement, but doesn't entirely solve the problem. The Book of Wisdom at the tail end of the sapiential tradition is a book which tries to handle that problem of evil and the problem of law and that problem of morality precisely by a recurrence to nature and to immortality. In the Book of Wisdom, it's set with the figure of King Solomon, even though it's really 1,000 years after the original King Solomon. It's set with the figure of King Solomon talking to his fellow kings and urging them that they need to be just. It pictures a group of Jews who have been killed for their fidelity to Torah, now waking up in the afterlife, and those who had been persecuted now become the judges of those who had persecuted them. But they must judge justly. And Solomon, later in the course of that book, in chapters 9 and 10, engages in a long prayer for wisdom. Solomon, who was known for his wisdom, especially from the time when the two harlots brought to him their children, one dead and one still living, both claiming the living child. And Solomon devised the strategy of cutting the living child in half, eliciting the shriek of the real mother, at which point he knew who that real mother was and could award her the child. Solomon admits that his wisdom didn't come simply from his own brilliance, but came from God, a God who, Solomon then explains in chapters 11 through chapter 19, a God who uses nature to aid his people, a God who uses that natural sanction that natural law has always envisioned to try to cultivate real honesty and real justice and to ward off evildoers. In short, it's a biblical appropriation of some of that natural law theory in the words of King Solomon. Now, that tradition in the wisdom literature is not a philosophical tradition, and yet it's as close to a philosophical tradition as the Bible ever gets, so far as I know. It's a willingness even to use that category of nature in combination with that category of creature. We still don't have a philosophical treatise, but we have a willingness to appreciate and to appropriate philosophical ideas such as the writers of the Book of Wisdom and other late sapiential books had yet experienced them. In the portion of the Bible that is written only with the coming of Christianity, we see that same theme developed yet further. Most of the New Testament is not philosophical. Rather, we have the Gospels, the records of Jesus' life and Jesus' teaching, and it's much more in the style of those biblical prophets. It's, again, the enunciation of a new covenant and the enunciation of a new law, the love of God above all with all one's mind and heart and soul and strength, and the enunciation of a law dealing with human beings, namely, we should love our neighbor as we love ourselves, the law of charity. But there's also, for the point of view of this course, an interesting way in which the natural law tradition manifests itself. I think it can be found in various portions of the New Testament, but for the sake of simplicity here, I'd like to concentrate on just one writing by St. Paul, namely his letter to the Romans. After explaining himself and his own basic perspective, a follower of the law, but one who sees the completion of, and fulfillment of the law in Jesus, he then turns to the subject of the pagans and the Gentiles, and how they could possibly be expected to act morally. In chapter 1, verses 17 to 23, Paul writes as follows, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men, who by their wickedness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them." In short, Paul is making a natural theology argument that, yes, he has been the beneficiary of revelation, but that all peoples, even those who've never known revelation, can still know about God and what he wants. He says, "Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So these people are without excuse, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God, or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and in their senseless minds they were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man or birds or animals or reptiles. The point, I think, here is that Paul is thinking about those first three commandments of the Decalogue, commandments which require the real worship of the true God. And he is suggesting that not only do the Jews who have received these commandments find themselves bound by them, but rather that there is a kind of a natural law obligation to worship the true God, because by our reasons, reflecting on all the things that have been made, one should be able to see that there is a God, an intelligent designer who has made these things, and hence one should never create an idol or a false god, but only honor a God who is superior, who is invisible, who is immutable and unchanging. Although it is impossible to detect a specific philosophical school from which Paul is borrowing, perhaps there is in Stoicism some of the basic assumptions and some of the basic concepts that he is using. A little later in that chapter, verses 24 to 28, one sees him showing the moral implications of this point about the worship of the true God that I just finished reading. Starting in chapter 1, verse 24, "Therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie, and they worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. Their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in their own persons the due penalty for their error." Now, at one level, this is a kind of moral psychology. I think that what Paul is urging is, if you have the true God, you will want to do what the true God wants you to do, and he's built enough of your enough right inclination into your nature that you'll do it. But if you've taken a false God, there will be implications for the way in which you live your life, and the dishonesty or the lie or the error that has been committed will, he thinks, result in a kind of a licentiousness, a willingness to follow out things that justify you. In a certain sense, there's a moral psychology here about how a fall away from true divinity can lead to a disorder in one's loves. But one can also see here, quite apart from that suggestion of moral psychology, one can see that he's making an argument based on nature, in this particular case dealing with matters of sexual intercourse, although natural law is by no means confined just to questions of sex. But his idea is that unnatural sexual intercourse is dishonorable, namely when it is directed to someone of the same sex. There is no argument here, and so I admit that this is not a philosophical treatise. Philosophers need to provide arguments. Biblical writers are in the tradition of revelation and are simply professing and are being prophets witnessing to the truth. But nonetheless, the language that he's using is the language of what is natural and unnatural. Let me quote one more passage from chapter 2 of St. Paul's letter to the Romans, again to sense how he himself envisioned himself in this early natural law tradition. He says, verse 12, "All who have sinned without the law," I presume he means without the law in the sense of the Decalogue, "will also perish without that law. And all who have sinned under the law," here he's speaking of the Jewish people who knew the Decalogue, "will be judged by that law. For it is not the hearers of the law who are righteous before God, but the doers of the law who will be justified." A sense that merely having had the law doesn't solve our problem. One has to obey it. "When Gentiles who do not have the law do by nature what the law requires, they are a law unto themselves, even though they do not have the law." In short, even though they don't have revealed law, they nonetheless have a law within their very natures. This is natural law thinking. "They show that what the law requires is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or perhaps excuse them on that day when, according to my gospel, God judges the secrets of men by Christ Jesus." There is here in Paul's language a sense of a natural law written on people's hearts, and then, as we heard, at the tail end of that particular passage, a sense of conscience. This will also be a theme of enormous importance to the natural law tradition, namely a sense that we have within us, as a part of our nature, already the basic principles of natural law able to be observed by sufficient inspection. With Augustine, it'll be a matter of introspection, of reading the law on our heart. With some other thinkers like Thomas Aquinas, it can also be external, looking at patterns of what are fruitful for human life, patterns which are in some way frustrating to human life. But the claim is that our nature already bears such a law because the author of our nature has already written it there. Not written it in so many words, but written it in that pattern of inclinations toward the natural end, toward what will fulfill us. There will be need for a much greater elaboration of this theory of conscience, but we already see with St. Paul a willingness of religious writers operating under revelation to embrace some of the same categories that the Stoics and Cicero were propounding philosophically. In the next lecture, we'll turn to some early Christian thinkers who were concerned with this notion of natural law, but found the additional problems coming from being in a fallen or wounded nature.